18-5622 USA versus Merrill Cook. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes of time. Ms. Salinas, advising attorney for the appellant.
Go ahead, Ms. Salinas.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This is Melissa Salinas, and I'm here as a superadvising attorney for Laurel Lusa and Kelsey McFulkin. We appreciate the court allowing students to argue this case and for allowing the argument to be via Zoom. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kelsey McFulkin, appearing for appellant Marilyn Cook. May I please reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
Rebuttal. 4 minutes.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Ms. Rizzo, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kelsey McFulkin, appearing for appellant Marilyn Cook. May I please reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. With our limited time today, I would like to focus on two issues. First, the government failed to produce sufficient evidence to convict Ms. Cook of presenting a fictitious financial instrument because her bill of exchange did not appear to be an actual financial instrument. Second, the district court abused its discretion in admitting evidence of Ms. Cook's prior conviction, as this highly prejudicial evidence was only used to show Ms. Cook has a propensity to commit fraud. The required element of the charge of presenting a fictitious financial instrument is that the document appears, represents to be an actual financial instrument. The government failed to produce sufficient evidence to prove this element, and therefore the conviction under count one cannot stand. Under the test articulated by this court in United States versus Heath, the financial instrument in question must bear a family resemblance or have sufficient hallmarks of a real instrument. Furthermore, there must be no disqualifying marks on the alleged fictitious financial instrument. In United States versus Heath for the district court, one mark was enough. And here we have several. First, the word negotiable on Ms. Cook's bill of exchange was spelled incorrectly. Not just one letter incorrectly, but blatantly, egregiously wrong, with several letters jumbled up and letters missing from the word.
So in your mind, a typo is a disqualifying mark? In other words, I've had lots of typos and lots of things that fortunately I've done over time that effectively disqualify, I mean, any writing where there's a typo rises to a level of being disqualifying.
So on an official financial instrument, a typo as egregious as the word negotiable, reading as neo-get-mobile, is a disqualifying mark. In addition, there were a few other disqualifying marks and certain hallmarks of a financial instrument.
I mean, what happens if you just have a Bank of America account and Bank of America put a typo on your check, and you just took the check to the bank to deposit? Maybe you fall on the intent part of the crime, but you're saying that typo, the Bank of America, they spelled it Bank of, they forgot the A at the end or something, that disqualifies the entire check. That feels a little nitpicky to me, to think that every person looking at the check has to read every word and make sure there's no typos.
The word negotiable in United States versus Heath, it was noted, is a particularly important word. So while maybe a typo somewhere else on the check wouldn't have made it disqualifying, United States versus Heath, the fact that the bill of exchange was listed as non-negotiable rather than negotiable was seen as enough to be a disqualifying mark. In addition, this bill of exchange had a barcode and it had an autograph line where it should have said a signature line.
Well, when you say should have said, that's not a matter of law, is it? I mean, to me, an autograph is a signature and vice versa. It normally says signature, but there's nothing by law that says it has to be, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But this detail on the bill of exchange further provides evidence that it did not appear to be an actual financial instrument.
But why do we want to reward the pretty good criminal, so the perfect criminal who does it perfectly, they don't have this argument. But the criminal who's just pretty good, but makes a couple small errors, why do we want to reward, why do we want to penalize that conduct less? I mean, this isn't like a dollar bill you buy at the toy, you know, the toy store you buy like $5 bill or something. It's like not that obviously fraudulent. So why do we have such a high bar, require such precision here?
It is a required element of the charge of presenting a fictitious financial instrument that the document does appear to be an actual instrument. Because it is required by the statute, it's a required element. That is why we must look closely to ensure that this element was actually met.
Well, I must say, if I just, you know, flipping pages and look at this thing, it says bill of exchange, and you know, it's not a standard check, but there is such a thing as a bill of exchange, and if it was properly drawn, it would be legit. So then you have to sit down and kind of nitpick it. You know, some family resemblances are better than other family resemblances, aren't they?
Yes, but there were a number of disqualifying marks, and this bill of exchange did not have enough of the hallmarks of a check or a bill of exchange so that it would appear to be an actual financial instrument. If you look at the bill of exchange, there's no account number, there's no routing number, there's no MIC.
No, there is this number up here in the upper right corner, MYPBOE 321194. I mean, it may be phony, but that looks like an account number.
It was not, though, and there's no bank listed from which to draw funds, which is key on a financial document when trying to deposit a check or a bill of exchange.
Well, it refers to Tennessee UCC account, trust account, and it has a number over there. That would, you know, I don't, it indeed clearly, you know, didn't exist, but it certainly looks like it could exist. I mean, is that the one that where you said there's no such account? I mean, that would be the closest to it, wouldn't it?
Yes, but again, that account is not the account from which the funds were attempted to be withdrawn. That is not listed anywhere on the bill of exchange. There was no way to try and deposit.
Well, I guess that the other thing that's sort of a little odd here, I mean, if you go into a bank and, you know, you... The old days, you give them a $3 bill with George McGovern's picture on it. They just laugh at you and send you away. Here, the bank went to, you know, some very considerable activity to delve into this and, you know, talk to her, and she comes back with more activity and so on. That they certainly seem to, that it was not laughably improper. Kind of what do we do with that?
The bank did try and help Ms. Cook out as a potential client, but all of the witnesses, all of the bank employees did testify that the bill of exchange looked unusual to them initially. The bank security investigator testified that the bill of exchange appeared fraudulent to him. Just looking at it, he knew almost right away that this was not a real bill of exchange. So although they did try and figure out if there was something to do with this bill of exchange, they noticed something was off right away, even if they didn't send Ms. Cook away immediately.
But there's kind of off, I mean, you said two things which I were both kind of right. It was unusual, and then the examiner after a bit thinks it's fraudulent. People pass counterfeit money and people catch it because it's unusual, but that doesn't get you off of the charge of passing counterfeit money if it has the family resemblance, right? I mean, as he said, it doesn't have to be perfect.
In this case, though, there simply weren't enough hallmarks of a true bill of exchange, and there were those disqualifying marks. Negotiable spelled Neo Get O'Reilly, and a barcode, which showed that this was not appearing.
The Neo Get O'Reilly, I agree, that was the first thing I saw, but the barcode, I mean, again, you know, my checks have magnetic ink numbers, but the difference between that and a barcode or a QR code, you know, the way banking is being done today, I wouldn't blanch If I got a document that had, let's say, a QR code rather than a magnetic ink encoding, would you? It's a great new idea, QR codes on your checks.
Perhaps not with that one specific detail, but all of the missing hallmarks, all of the disqualifying marks taken together show that this just doesn't meet the element of appearing to be an actual financial instrument.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I believe the timer might have been set incorrectly. My colleague Laura Russo will be doing a 4-minute rebuttal, but I don't believe I started out with
a no, I don't think it was correct. I think it was thought that your colleague was sharing your first argument with you. So if you'd like to address something else, you're certainly welcome to do so.
Yeah, the sheet that we have actually had your colleague first and then giving you 6 minutes.
Should I give we'll 5 more minutes and then your colleague can argue?
You're doing the entire first argument,
yes,
is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
And then Ms. Ruza is doing the rebuttal?
Yes, that's correct.
And how long for rebuttal?
4.
Okay, so yes, he should get 5 more minutes.
I apologize.
This is like the line judge in football. Place 5 more minutes back on the clock. Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Turning to the second issue I'd like to discuss today is the district court's abuse of discretion in admitting evidence of Ms. Cook's prior conviction. This prior conviction was highly prejudicial. It was not probative of Ms. Cook's intent in this case. And in fact, it was merely used as propensity evidence to show that Ms. Cook committed fraud once before, and therefore she committed fraud in this case as well. This evidence was prejudicial. The district court admitted details that Ms. Cook's prior conviction involved low-income individuals who she lured in with faith-based messaging and promises of financial support. She obtained their personally identifying information and used it to obtain their tax refunds for herself. These highly prejudicial details were stuck in the mind of the jury and substantially outweighed any probative value of the evidence. This evidence is not probative of intent. To determine whether evidence is probative of intent, this court will look at temporal proximity and substantial similarity of a prior act. Ms. Cook's prior conviction involved actions that were 15 years prior to her alleged actions in this case. That significant gap of time reduces any notion of temporal proximity. As to substantial similarity, there were key factual differences and differences in her conduct between her prior conviction and this case. Ms. Cook's prior conviction involved individuals for whom she obtained personally identifying information. This case involved a bill of exchange unrelated to tax returns and her own tax returns, which she wrote in and out with the IRS deemed in error. Because this evidence was not temporally proximate and not substantially similar, it was not probative of intent. Rather, propensity was the only way this evidence was probative, because she committed fraud once, committed fraud again.
So both acts of, I'm trying to remember correctly, but both acts involved the same nonprofit organization?
For prior conviction and count two, both referenced Sheet Ministries, that's correct.
So that's some similarity, maybe significant amount of similarity.
But to probative of intent, we must reach this level of substantial similarity. But the more nuanced look, then she was involved before and was involved now, so they must be substantially similar. Those factual circumstances about individuals, Ms. Cook's conduct, were very different in her prior conviction versus this case, which did not involve any individuals directly, which involved very different conduct on her part.
I suppose the details were slightly different, but the idea is she used the same nonprofit to file false tax returns twice, right? Just changed up the mechanism a little bit.
Yes, In her prior conviction, it was individuals. She did not file anything in her own name. And in the incident case, the charges involved her own tax return. She was not using anyone else's information. It was just what she was submitting to the IRS as her own tax return, which is a key factual difference and would render these not substantially similar.
Can I ask, on your temporal proximity point, so you're saying there's 15 years difference between the two events. Are you arguing that over a certain amount of time it can never be considered, or that's just something we need to consider in the broader spectrum of all the evidence that shows substantial similarity or doesn't show substantial similarity?
It's something that must be considered in the broader overall consideration in determining the probative value of this evidence. So this court has never said that certain length of time means that the prior act cannot be probative of intent, but we must look at both pieces together. This propensity evidence had a powerful impact on this case. The district court judge specifically pointed to this evidence and denied Elbow Counsel's Rule 29 motion for judgment of acquittal. The government brought up this prior conviction in closing arguments just before informing the jury to return a verdict that tells Ms. Cook the schemes are over. We ask this court to vacate Ms. Cook's conviction and sentence and remand for further proceedings. If there are no further questions, I believe I'm about out of time.
The judge did instruct the jury that the evidence could only be considered as it relates to intent, right?
She did, but a jury instruction will not always say prejudicial evidence. The inflammatory details that would have led the jury to identify with Ms. Cook's prior victims and prior conviction meant that a jury instruction would not be enough, that the jury would only consider her intent in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Frank Dale, and I'm here representing the United States of America in this matter. And Marilyn Cook received a fair trial. The judge carefully considered the evidence in the case and provided proper and correct, legally sound evidentiary rulings. Cook was found guilty, and this court should affirm that conviction. Opposing counsel's noted, Cook raised a number of issues. I agree that the most important issues here go to sufficiency of the evidence and to the 404B evidence as well, and I'm happy to talk about those, but also other issues as the court would like me to. But let's address first the sufficiency of the evidence issue. The United States provided a mountain of evidence showing Ms. Cook's intent in presenting a bogus bill of exchange drawn in the amount of $1 million. Now, opposing counsel says, well, it lacked the hallmarks of a legitimate financial instrument. In truth, it possessed many of the elements of a real financial instrument.
Well, she said it had too many disqualifying marks.
Certainly.
And so there's this case that says that the word non-negotiable by its, I mean, maybe, I don't know if this is how you read the case, but the phrase non-negotiable by itself is enough to, however accurate and precise the rest of the document is, that one phrase can disqualify the check from being something that someone would reasonably think could be a financial instrument.
And that's exactly right. Putting non-negotiable on an instrument would be a disqualifying point. Stamping void across the front of the check would be disqualifying. But there's a difference between an outright disqualifying indication on the document and not having sufficient hallmarks or sufficient verisimilitude that would lead us to conclude, or would lead a banker to conclude, that this might be the real thing. I provided a copy of an image of the check in the brief,
is the standard even a banker? The standard isn't a banker, right? It's just a reasonable person might be confused.
You're correct, Judge, and I misspoke. It doesn't go to the extent of saying a reasonable banker. It just a reasonable person looking at the document. And we passed out the actual document, but we published it to the jury so they could look at it, turn it over and over in their hands. It was printed on check stock paper. It had security features on both the front and the back of the document. When Ms. Cook prepared this document, she went to a lot of trouble to make sure this was a document that looked like the real thing.
Security features, does that mean like a watermark or just that it says security? At the top it says, warning, this document has security features. Is that what you were referring to?
Yes, sir. Security features like heat-sensitive ink where you've put your finger on.
Okay, so it did letters. Have those?
Yes, sir, it did. Okay. And there were some features that made it different from a regular check, but that's not the standard. The standard is whether it bears a fair approximation of a legitimate financial instrument. In this case, it had a dollar amount. It had a person to whom it was payable. It had an account number on it, although it was a reference to a bogus treasury account. And I want to point out what happened when she gave this check, this bill of exchange to the bank employees. They didn't look at it outright and say, this is bogus, this is phony. Instead, the head banker tried to put this thing through the Panini machine, which would read the features off a legitimate check. It didn't do that. But she didn't say, it won't read it, it must be bogus. She thought perhaps it was a collection item. And similar to a check drawn on a Bank of Australia or Austria brought into the bank. It doesn't mean that it's out and out invalid, but that it can't be processed automatically and it needs to be sent to another branch of the bank to be treated as appropriate. It was only later when Furlong and Fair provided this document to the bank's security officer, Bobby Schaefer, that he looked at it, and based on his experience and training, he looked at it and he said, this is bogus, and then he called law enforcement on it. But it certainly passed muster when she took it into the bank. Initially, when she talked with the first bank employee about this, the employee testified, this wasn't like an instrument I'd seen before, not like a check I'd seen before. Ms. Cook was ready with an answer. She said, it's because it's drawn on a private trust. That's the reason it doesn't look like instruments you've seen in the past. So, certainly there were no disqualifying features on this document. It bore enough features to pass this verisimilitude standard to bear the hallmarks of legitimate financial instrument.
Can I ask about the prior conviction?
Yes, sir.
It seems like our case law creates sort of a narrow lane. If the prior conviction is the exact same, sometimes it shouldn't come in because it's just too obvious propensity evidence.
Sure.
But if it's not similar enough, then it also doesn't come in because it wouldn't go to show intent or something like that. So it's sort of this like narrow band of offense that's pretty similar but not the exact same. Is that how you read our case law? Or?
That's exactly right. If it is the same offense, then yes, there can be problems with doing this. But a fair enough similarity and temporal proximity also, as opposing counsel has noted, can be another factor. And it's true that in this case, there were 15 years that passed between the prior conviction and presenting this conviction in the present case. However, there were enough similarities between the two of them that it certainly went to show intent on the part of Ms. Cook. And intent was an issue that she had brought up directly in the course of her case. She said, I had no intent to defraud anyone, either as to the 514 crime or as to the 287 crime. And as Judge Riedler, as you noted in the prior argument, it was the same entity. It was Sheep Ministries that was involved in the prior crime and was brought up in the incident offense.
And what was the instruction that the judge gave? Did it kind of track these two things that Judge Riedler raised? The instruction as to accepting it for only some items. Exactly what was that instruction?
Your Honor, I could find it in the record, but my recollection was that she said you can consider this only for intent. She made it clear that it could not be considered for propensity purposes, but just for intent and not for other reasons. I believe that's my recollection of what it was for. And it certainly went to that because there were clear linkages with the present case. I want to note that Judge Reese was careful, very careful, in what she allowed to come in and what she wouldn't allow to come in. She wouldn't allow testimony, for instance, on the number of victims, the dollar amounts of the fraud, or what kind of sentence that Ms. Cook received. She narrowly restrained what would be allowed in. Now, one of those was that it was a faith-based organization that took advantage of indigent individuals. But it's clear that Ms. Cook decided at the outset to use the name Sheep Ministries and on her tax return. Again, she used sheep. Again, she called it a nonprofit. Again, she called herself an executive director. All of these indicators of a nonprofit organization. So there was a clear linkage between the two of them, and that could overcome her argument that she had no intent with respect to these to this present offense. I want to also address just a point or two that opposing counsel noted that the victim was different. There was a claim that the victim in the past case was individuals, indigent individuals, who Ms. Cook prepared tax returns on behalf of and was able to obtain refunds to which they were not entitled. And in the present case, she was seeking a refund on her own. The reality, though, is that in both cases, it's the Internal Revenue Service, the United States, that is paying out a bogus return. It's the same offense for those purposes.
Can I ask you about a different issue? Did Judge Reeves have authority to impose a consecutive sentence or consecutive to the sentence to be imposed in California, which I guess has now been imposed?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that she did have the authority to do that under the statute. However, as Your Honor has noted, that
statute
3584 Title 18, I believe.
Yes. Yep. Go ahead.
The argument being that it deprived a subsequent judge of the ability to impose a consecutive or a non-consecutive sentence. However, since a consecutive sentence has been imposed now by the court in California, that really isn't an issue before the court at this present time.
It's sort of like a harmless error analysis, or?
I believe it's been mooted at this point.
What if that other sentence was reversed on appeal or something, it was commuted or something happened to it?
Then it would be a live issue again. But at this point,
I'm not sure the defendant could raise it then.
What language are you relying on to say that she had the authority to do that?
I believe it's in 3584. I'm doing this off from memory, but I believe the statute does give the trial court the authority, the discretion to impose a consecutive sentence or a concurrent sentence.
Even consecutive to something that hasn't happened, although as it turned out now it has happened, right? We have the California sentencing.
I don't think that there is a restriction that's placed upon that by the statute. On the other hand, I don't think this is an issue this circuit has addressed.
We don't have any binding precedent on it, and the standard review is plain error, right?
That's correct, because it was not raised. There was no objection made to the sentence at the trial court level. There was a Setzer case with U.S. Supreme Court. However, that was the instance of a state court sentence and a federal court sentence, so we would argue it isn't a posit to this matter.
And was there any... first of all, did the court ask the BASTA question? At the end of sentencing, did the court ask whether there were any objections?
She did, yes.
And, okay. And there so were... was there any objection to asserting that she inadequately explained why she was imposing consecutive sentences?
There was no statement that dealt specifically with the imposition of a consecutive sentence. However, it was essentially all rolled into one. She gave her basis for why that she was imposing the sentence under 3553, a sentence that was sufficient but not greater than necessary to meet the factors of 3553, which also explained her reasoning for going to the top of the applicable guideline scale, but nonetheless denying the government's motion to vary upward.
And now that the California judge has said that sentence should be consecutive, does it really make any difference at all?
It really does not, except in the case, as Judge Riedler said that... As Judge Riedler says, if that sentence were commuted or overruled, then perhaps we could come back to that.
So I don't understand where the authority comes from. It says, if multiple terms of imprisonment are imposed on a defendant at the same time, or if a term of imprisonment is imposed on a defendant who is already subject to an undischarged term of imprisonment, the terms may run concurrently or consecutively. And then it says, if they're imposed at the same time, they are generally concurrent, and if they're different times, they're generally consecutive. But it still begins with the premise that they're either being imposed at the same time or the defendant's already subject to an undischarged term of imprisonment.
That is that it's a retrospective, not prospective.
Right.
We could provide further briefing on this point if the court would like. I don't believe this is an issue that we've dealt with directly in our briefing.
I mean, it's...
Well, one thought, I mean, the statute doesn't, it suggests one approach, but doesn't necessarily foreclose a different approach. I think it suggests the reading that Judge White gave it, but maybe it doesn't completely foreclose that. And then there's a no objection, so we're here on plain error, and we don't have a circuit decision that controls.
And I think that is the correct analysis on that. There are perhaps other ways in which we could interpret that statute that are different from what I expressed, that the statute provides the court with automatic difference in that instance, right? Does the court have other questions?
Questions? Nope. Thank you.
Nothing else? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Laurel Ruzza on behalf of the appellant Marilyn Cook. I would like to make 2 points on rebuttal. First, the district court judge in this case did improperly tie the hands of the California district court judge by requiring that this sentence run consecutive to whatever the future judge sentence the judge imposed. The plain meaning of the text of 3584A is that a district court judge cannot impose a consecutive sentence to a not yet imposed sentence. The statute says if a term of imprisonment is imposed on a defendant who is already subject to an undischarged term of imprisonment, the word already is key here. In the sentence, in the context of the statute, it can only mean one thing, that this is left to the later judge's decision whether this should run concurrent or consecutively.
Okay, counsel, that certainly makes sense, but she was sentenced, and from the transcript, it looked like the judge made, looks like it was a man, his own decision to sentence her consecutively.
Yes, so the fact that the sentence in the California court has happened actually makes this issue even more important. Because regardless of what the California judge stated on the transcript, there still is that judge did still know that the judge in this case said that this had to be consecutively sentenced. Therefore, the judge in the California case may have felt bound
if you read the transcript, the judge in California was pretty much happy to pile on even more sentencing. If you read it, he didn't sound like he was giving any deference to Tennessee. He was saying that he was pretty outraged. So I didn't see that he felt that he was being overborne by this outrageously punitive Tennessee judge. If you read the transcript of the sentencing.
Regardless, Your Honor, the fact that the statute is quite clear in the language still impacted and or could have impacted the California District Court judge, which is improper, and that's why this should this needs the plain.
But then what's the remedy on that if we were to agree with you and remand or strike that part? That doesn't bind the California judge either. He's already sentenced. I suppose you could go out and make some sort of a post-trial motion, but it doesn't undercut his sentence, does it?
No, Your Honor. However, she could address this in her appeal that she already gave a notice of appeal in the Ninth Circuit, and she could make a post-trial motion to remedy it in the appeal court. Additionally, Ms. Cook's prior conviction was improperly admitted for propensity.
Can I ask you, counsel, on the last point, just to finish off, you agree that our circuit has never, we've never read the statute expressly the way you're reading it today?
Correct. This question, to my knowledge and research, has not been before this court, and this court has not determined that yet. However, from reading the plain language of this statute.
Do you also agree our review is plain error here?
Yes, Your Honor. Regardless, this is the plain error is met because it is clear and obvious from the language of the statute. And I see that my time has expired, and we would ask that this court vacate and remand this court's convictions. Thank you.
You were going to say something about the 404 evidence, and Judge Widler asked questions. If you just want to add that comment now, you can.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So on the prior conviction point, in United States versus Bell, this court held that similar charges were not probative of intent under 404B, and that to be probative of intent, the prior conviction and charged crime had to be of a similar scheme. The simple fact that the two schemes were under the name Sheep Ministries does not meet the substantial similarity test. Further, Ms. Cook and her elbow counsel did object to certain facts coming in that ended up being read to the jury and coming into evidence through Special Agent Frayler, including the religious-based scheme and the individuals from the prior conviction. Therefore, this was entered simply for propensity purposes to show that Ms. Cook committed fraud once, therefore she must have done it again. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And we thank the clinic for providing the defense and for training the future lawyers. And counsel, thank you for obliging with this hybrid presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.